It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Later in the program, it's Food Friday, and we'll be talking with a chef who's got some recipes from his three favorite food groups, pigs, pickles, and whiskey. That's coming up in about 10 minutes.
First, terrorist acts in Russia have been making headlines this week. Twin bombings in the town of Volgograd have claimed the lives of at least 30, with dozens more being injured.
The bombings come just weeks before the city of Sochi hosts the Winter Olympics, raising security concerns at a time when all eyes will be on Russia.
Helping us now to make some sense of the situation is Christopher Swift. He is an adjunct professor of national security studies at Georgetown University and an international lawyer at Foley & Lardner. Christopher, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Gene. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
I want to start out with the city of Volgograd itself. A lot of people might remember it as Stalingrad. But why are we seeing these bombings here, do you suppose?
Well, there are two reasons. The first is opportunistic, and the second is strategic. And let me answer each of those elements in reverse. Volgograd is one of the largest cities in southern Russia, and it's a major transportation hub. So if you're traveling by bus or you're traveling by train, which a lot of people in Russia do, or even if you're traveling by airplane, there's a fair chance that if you're coming from northern or central or eastern Russia and going to locations in the south like Sochi or Rostov-on-Don or some of the other cities, that you're going to go through Volgograd. And so by targeting the transportation infrastructure in Volgograd, The terrorists involved in these two bombings this past week were essentially sending a message to the Russian government in Moscow saying, you know, we can compromise you at this particular choke point. We can take advantage of all of these weaknesses you have in advance of the Olympics. Now, the opportunistic side is this is about as far north into Russian territory as the Caucasus Emirate, that's the name of the terrorist syndicate operating in the region, has been able to get in recent years. It's been since 2010 that they've, you know, the last time they had a major operation in Moscow was 2010 or 2011. Since then, they've mostly been focused on the North Caucasus region, sometimes in Krasnodar, which is another southern region, and the furthest north they've been able to get in the last couple of years has been Volgograd.
And so
those are the two reasons why this city's in the news.
And really, that opportunistic and strategic element there, they can really have an outsized impact. These two bombings, you know, there are people killed and all of that, but even so, it really does send a message, and it's almost larger than it might appear to be at first blush.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. You know, having read the Russian press and having spent, you know, the last 15 years of my life studying this particular group, including, you know, doing interviews with rebels and, you know, being out in the field in Dagestan and the Dagestan-Chechnya border, it's my impression that the first of these two bombings, a woman by the name of Oksana Aslanova, was actually trying to get on a passenger train bound from Volgograd north to Moscow. And you've got to remember that the weekend right before the New Year's holiday is the most important travel weekend for Russians and Russian families. New Year's is the biggest celebration of the year. Orthodox Christian Christmas this year falls on the 7th of January. And that two-week period sort of starting right before the new year, that's when everybody takes vacation during the winter. So getting on a train and detonating a weapon that looks like it was made of plastic explosives that large would have been an even larger event. And there's a strong possibility here, based on my reading of the scenario, that the Russian security services may have dodged a bullet. Losing 18 people in a train station bombing is one thing, but losing scores more in a train derailment is another.
And this comes right in a month or two in advance of the Winter Olympic Games in Sochi, which are about 400 miles away. But obviously, if this
is right.
A big transportation hub, the crowds, everything, the potential is there. Let's put it like that. So what does this force the Russian security forces to try to do? I mean, where does this leave them in all this?
Well, there's two things going on. In the run-up to Sochi, the Kremlin and the Russian security services, including the MVD, the Interior Ministry, the Russian equivalent of the FBI, And the FSB, the Federal Security Services, the successor agency to the KGB, both of those agencies have created what Vladimir Putin has called the Ring of Steel around Sochi. And the idea is to, put in magnetometers at train stations and bus stations to increase the number of checkpoints, to increase the number of individuals manning those checkpoints. They've been very keen on securing airline traffic into and out of Sochi. The problem is that, that Ring of Steel is only as strong as its weakest link. And corruption is so endemic at the lower and middle levels of the Russian security services, more so in the police than in the FSB. But even then, it's such a concern. And the group involved here has such strong incentives to try to make something happen, or at least to attempt something, that it's hard to see how the Russian government is going to be able to secure all of the venues to the degree that they would like to. It's important to note that, if you're looking at this from the perspective of the insurgent group in the region, again, it's called the Caucasus Emirate, a try and a miss is still a victory for them, because the point there is to sow fear and concern and anxiety in the population. And, with terrorism, it's sort of an all-or-nothing game. As soon as you have an event, you have a failure. And it's hard to be, it's hard to bat 1,000 in every aspect of life, especially when you've got an adversary that's as ruthless and resilient as this particular group is.
And so, refresh my memory, what is the Caucasus Emirate after in all of this?
Sure. Well, going back 20 years, in 1994, Russia and Chechnya began a war over whether Chechnya would break away from the Russian Federation and form an independent state. And for the last 350 years, the Russians and the Chechens have been fighting over whether Chechnya would be part of Russia or whether Chechnya would go back to being sort of its own self-governing region. During the space of that 20 years, between 1994 and today, they fought two formal wars, two large-scale conventional wars, and now they're fighting sort of a protracted, very radicalized insurgency. And much like what we're seeing in Syria today, what happened with the Chechen cause is it radicalized, it became more marginal, but it also internationalized, or in their case, regionalized. So what started out with a bunch of Chechens trying to create an independent Republic of Chechnya turned into an Islamist movement and then a radical Salafist movement. And as they've become more radical and more marginal politically, they've also reached out to other different groups. You've got to remember about 18 to 20% of Russia's population is comprised of indigenous Muslims. So they've been reaching out to Dagestanis, they've been reaching out to Ingush, they've been reaching out to Tartars, they've been reaching out to ethnic Slavic converts to Islam, and trying to pull these people into a movement that would create an Islamic state on Russia's southern border. Very different from where they started, and very troubling for Russia and for the Olympics.
Yeah, absolutely. And the last time we heard some of these stories, this history, was during the Boston Marathon bombings just about a year ago.
Right.
And people are trying desperately, I think, to draw a connection there. Do you think there is one?
No, I don't think there is one, and here's why. Look, at a very superficial level, we have people that have radicalized, and we have people that are using terrorism in order to fulfill their political objectives or their personal objectives. But when you look at what was motivating Zhohar and Tamerlane Tsarnaev in Boston, if you look at the stuff that, Zhohar had written on the inside of the sailboat when the FBI finally captured him, all of that stuff was about U.S. policy in Afghanistan and Iraq, right? So they might have been from Chechnya and Dagestan. One side of the family's Chechen, one side of the family's Dagestani, but they'd lived there for maybe 18 months since they were 3 or 4 years old. The family actually left and came to the United States to get away from the war because, their parents and their uncles didn't want anything to do with it. What we see with the Caucasus Emirate is a group that started off as a secular nationalist movement, became an Islamist movement, and then eventually radicalized into this nasty little, Salafist jihadi movement. But their focus has always been on Russia. They've never been operational outside the region. There are some Chechens who have globalized, but we're talking about, tens and talking about dozens of people, not hundreds or thousands of people. And the connections between the two, aside from the fact that people are from the same ethnic group, and aside from the fact that people have been blowing things up, no one's been able to tie those operational connections together. And when you look at the objectives they were fighting for, they don't align.
Well, it's a very interesting and very complicated story. Christopher, thanks for taking the time to help us out with it today.
It's my pleasure, Gene.
Christopher Swift is an adjunct professor of national security studies at Georgetown University and an international lawyer at Foley and Lardner.
After the break, we head south in today's edition of Food Friday and get some great recipes from the world of Southern cuisine. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Our next guest has made a career out of cooking. And as a James Beard Award-winning chef, he'll be the first to admit that cooking is hard work.
But he says it should also be fun. And in this week's Food Friday segment, we're learning how to make great food and have a good time.
John Currence is the owner of the City Grocery Restaurant Group. It's based in Oxford, Mississippi. And he is the author of the book we're going to be talking about, Pickles, Pigs, and Whiskey, Recipes from My Three Favorite Food Groups, and Then Some. John, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, guys. How are you all?
We're doing pretty well. We're a little colder than you, but aside from that, we're doing fine. I want to talk...
That's all relative. That's all relative.
True that. I want to start talking about, before we get into the recipes, because we want to spend a lot of time with that, sort of getting in the mood for cooking. And you try to make cooking in the kitchen an event. You have some wine. You've got some music. You try to make it a good time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember as a as a child, sort of the revelry that went into time in the kitchen, in my family's house and my grandparents' house, and it never seemed like a chore, until cleanup time came. Of course, there was always so much joy involved in being in the kitchen at my grandparents' house, handling this food that had come straight out of the garden. Or from animals that had, had just been killed or what have you. And so, it's very odd, for me to think about, through time warp, how we've gotten from that to, a time now where, cooking is drudgery. It's a chore. It's, it's just sort of onerous beast that, that folks address and they try to marginalize as much as possible because it's just, time-consuming and work, and without sort of saying it out now, the book is sort of an appeal for folks to, try to find the joy in cooking again. I mean, there's so much to it that it should be easy.
And one of the ways you get that done is in this book, you include a song for every recipe you've got there. What is it about music that makes cooking fun?
Well, I mean, I guess it may be more personal than anything else, but because music is played a a huge role in my life. I tell folks that I started my life at a Beatles concert. My mother took a group of her students in 1964 to City Park Stadium in New Orleans to see the Beatles when I was I was a month away from being born, and so that the Beatles was the first concert that I was at, and I've seen so many acts over the years and played in a band for 7 years, and it's been a huge part of my life, and it just became a natural part of the kitchen, and it is a part of lots of kitchens, and I think it's just music can set the tone, whether it be metal that sort of gets the heart rate going, or classical music that just kind of calms the situation down. We listen to a little bit of everything, and whether it's at home or at work, I think it helps enhance the the mood of whatever the situation is.
And let's talk about food for a second here, as long as we're talking about a cookbook. You talk about your three favorite food groups, pickles, pigs, and whiskey. And, pickling seems to be kind of I don't know if it's a forgotten art, but it does seem to be something that's making a resurgence these days. What is it about pickling that really appeals to you?
Well, I guess it starts with the fact that, you know, vinegar is perhaps my, you know, my favorite condiment. And, you know, it'd be real easy to make the case for the fact, you know, that I was just lazy,
mm-hmm.
You know, but it is a very, very simple process, you know, that has kind of gotten a bad rap because when folks, you know, approach it, you know, it's all of a sudden it's, oh God, we have to have tongs and a pot for sterilizing and jars and rings and lids and, you know, everything about it seems, you know, very sort of clinical and, you know, and laborious. When in fact, you know, you can make pickles and stick them in the refrigerator and they'll keep forever.
And it seems like you haven't met a food that you don't want to pickle. You've even got a recipe in here for pickled Honeycrisp apples.
Right, right. And, you know, for things like that, you know, are apples better? Is a Honeycrisp apple better pickled than it is, you know, fresh? You know, probably not. But you take something in, you know, like a Honeycrisp, and you enhance the flavor with a little bit of vinegar, turn it into something else, and it becomes an interesting addition to, you know, a salad as part of a, you know, a relish to go along with some grilled meat. You know, it just, you know, you still have the texture. You can still get the flavor of the apple, but all of a sudden you get the zing of the vinegar to go along with it. So, you know, but then there are things, you know, in there like, you know, like the pickled okra, which are absolutely quintessential.
You also spend a lot of time in your book talking about desserts, and that really attracted us here in the northern climates right now because we need all the calories we can get in the next couple of days. There was one in particular that caught our eye. It was this chocolate espresso jolt cake. The jolt cake.
Right. That and it sounds like you make it with jolt cola.
Yeah, I remember that. Twice the sugar and double the caffeine or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's... I reference that in the head note, and that was, you know, that was the idea. Young in my career, you know, I really sort of noticed that, like, when I would go to these, you know, these big meals, these multi-course meals, that, like, by the time you got to dessert, you know, you were just literally exhausted. And, you know, as much as I, you know, would be a 20-something-year-old and, you know, feel like I ought to want to just load up and go out and have drinks when dinner's over, all I wanted to do was go to bed. And, you know, so I wanted to come up with something that just sort of, like, shot the senses and the nerve endings and everything in between, you know. So there's the, you know, the caffeine and the chocolate and then this added espresso to it. And it's a lovely cake. It, you know, and it's a flourless chocolate cake. So it's really, you know, it's very fudgy. And when it cools, it's very dense. It's odd. Straight out of the oven, you know, it's this wonderful, like, pudding cake. But once it cools, it, you know, the butter hardens and the chocolate hardens, and you get this really sort of dense, fudgy thing. And it's absolutely wonderful. And it was a white chocolate mousse were the two first desserts that we ever served at City Grocery when we opened in 1992.
So I'm assuming you can still buy Jolt Cola then.
No, you can't, actually.
You can't buy it. So what, do you just use Coca-Cola or something like that?
Well, there's not in there. The jolt is meant to be just sort of the jolt you get from the caffeine.
Ah, gotcha.
But it worked well because of, you know, sort of in those days, you know, of the early part of my career when I was living off of Jolt Cola and no-dose pills, remember those crazy caffeine pills and... you know, that's how I got through, you know, the end of college. And when I was working 4 or 5 cooking jobs, I, like, stayed awake at times.
And I should point out that we do have the recipe for that jolt cake up on the Central Time Facebook page. So if you're in the mood for something fudgy, chocolate pudding cakey, as we just heard it described, you can head over to the Central Time Facebook page and check it out for the recipe. Maybe something to do during the bitter weather coming our way. Now, we haven't talked yet about pigs, which is the third part of what you love in this cookbook here. Bacon is something that's dear to your heart. Real quickly, in our next 30 seconds or so, what do you love about bacon?
I mean, it's just, it's one of those things. It's just, it's been so omnipresent. And, you know, I've been exposed to so many different varieties of it, whether it was, you know, straight off of butchered hogs at, you know, my grandfather, you know, took in, you know, or, you know, these different varieties of store-bought that I grew up with, or, you know, now the gazillion varieties of boutique bacons that are out there. It's, you know, it's just one of those things that, you know, there's nothing else in the world that comes close to tasting like it.
And there we go. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. John Currence, thanks so much for joining us. John Currence is a James Beard Award-winning chef, owner of the City Grocery Restaurant Group based in Oxford, Mississippi, and author of Pickles, Pigs, and Whiskey, recipes from my three favorite food groups, and then some.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after the news, NPR's Brooke Gladstone joins us for a look at current issues facing the media. Plus, she'll talk about her career as the host of On the Media.
And still ahead, a look at dietary supplements. Are they safe? And do the health benefits outweigh possible health risks? I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Still ahead on the show, the state is bracing for an Arctic blast, and we'll tell you how to be prepared and be safe.
Beginning tonight, NPR's On the Media joins the Friday night lineup here on the Ideas Network. In addition to its Sunday morning time slot, you can now hear it right after Central Time on Fridays.
Over the years, On the Media has been highly regarded for its exploration of the vast media landscape, aiming to lift the veil on how the media sausage is made.
Brooke Gladstone is the co-host and managing editor of On the Media. She joins us now to talk about the program and what's ahead for it this coming year. Brooke, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me. And thanks for having me the show at 8 on Friday nights. That's when it's the absolute freshest. And I'm always happy when it shows up on the air just as soon as we make it.
Nice. So you put it to bed on Friday afternoon sometime then?
That's right. Yeah. In fact, we generally post around 7 or 8 o'clock Eastern time. So you guys are getting it hot off the presses, which is how we do it in New York, as well as various times during the weekend. But it's always my preference that the show never be aired past the weekend. That's my sell-by date.
Well, lots of our listeners are already familiar with On the Media. It's been airing on the weekends here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering how you think the media landscape has evolved since the show began.
Oh, my God. I mean, we might as well be living on a different planet. When we, when Bob and I first did the show, the big new innovation was DVD extras and director's tracks and things like that. We thought that was just so cool. Listening to that old stuff now, it's like, you know, the 8-track tape I don't know, the buggy whip. I mean, there wasn't any Twitter. There wasn't any Facebook. There, you know, blogs were just beginning to become part of the conversation. I mean, we're talking about 2000, right? You know, it was just not... I mean, when the show had been around since the mid-90s, but it went national in the late 90s, and then Bob and I started at the third millennium and relaunched it and retweaked it and changed its priorities and so on.
Now, as I understand it, you were the first media reporter to be hired by NPR. Did
Right.
you ever expect to see the explosion of media that we see today?
I suppose there are visionaries out there who could have, but I was fresh off of a gig 3 years in Moscow for NPR. And, you know, when I had left in 92, there were only like 3 networks. When I came back, there were 5. You know, the whole situation had changed radically. I had an empty Rolodex. And no, I could not have imagined what has come to pass, how the very definition of media changed, and how the way we interact with it has been completely revolutionized. I mean, there is much of the hysterics about the development of media center around a lot of what has happened many times in the past. Every time there was a new form of media, there was a set of very similar hysterics about it. The thing that is truly new is the fact that it's gone from one too many to many to many. And that's just an entirely different equation that will yield very different results.
Well, and the other aspect of this is that all of the new media we're talking about, it's so tightly wound up with technology, you can't really stay up on one without staying up on the other. And it moves quickly, as we're talking about. You know, my 8-year-old has to tell me how to do stuff these days. Is it challenging for you to keep up with everything you need to know in both the media landscape and technology?
Yes. Thank God I'm not doing the show by myself. In fact, we have a new, essentially it's a blog that has there are new posts twice a day, and then there's a weekly audio component called TLDR, which is internet lingo for too long didn't read. It's about things that just take too long to consume. These are short bites that talk all about the culture of life online. It is something that, you know, probes well beyond the gadgetry into what is truly change-worthy about the way that we live, the way that we regard ourselves in as part of the world, as leading a conscious life. There's just incredible things that, and those are done by, I mean, that's run by PJ Vogt and Alex Goldman, two producers on our staff who are considerably younger than I am. I have been considering taking a coding class, but mostly I try and take the big picture. I mean, even gaming, I did a whole hour on gaming that I loved, but when I tried to game on a old game called EverQuest, one of those, you know, dragony dungeony shows, I called myself a gnome named Kreplach, and I fell down. And I could never get up. We even called the people who designed the game. I'm sure Kreplach is still moldering in EverQuest somewhere.
Oh, that's hilarious. Well, as you're keeping an eye on not just the technology, but, you know, the media smorgasbord that's out there each week, and you're putting together your show, how do you decide what to focus on every week when there's so much to choose from?
Yeah, this is where a lot of things that aren't explicitly media get squeezed through what I call the on-the-media Play-Doh extruder, so that they come out media-shaped. Because I'm not interested in media as a topic in itself. Never have been. I consider it a kind of a bizarre strength. I am interested in media insofar as it can tell me about modern life, that it can tell me about human psychology or how we perceive and filter our world. I'm interested in policies and trends insofar as they may affect the way that I see the world or the way that I see myself. So everything has to have important stakes. Everything has to have stakes for the average person who doesn't care about the media, so that they can understand why this is important or fascinating for them as people who don't regard themselves as specialists. All this time, I have never seen myself as any more than a curious person who wants to lead a conscious life. And you can't do that without understanding how the news media is created, how it works itself upon you, what the sources of the media are, the biases that work on the media. All of those things help you lead a conscious life and have a hope of trying to extract some nuggets of truth out of all of the ore out there.
Well, that's a pretty mind-blowing thing to say. The host of On the Media is not interested in the media and never has been. Does that?
I know. And actually, I can't believe that I've actually just said that.
on the record,
But it is on the record. And the thing is that's because you asked, how do we choose? It's never, hey, this guy is doing something kind of interesting. I mean, my first question is, interesting to whom? Why? What do you care about it? What is the larger story that it tells? And when we're doing our show right, then every single interview, every single piece tells a larger story. We had a great piece that we ran. We did a show devoted to, of all things, intellectual property and copyright last week. You can't, you know, what could be more yawn-worthy than that? But the show was fascinating. And one of the best parts of it was an analysis, a discussion, a history of the song Happy Birthday. And it tells you everything you need to know about what is ridiculous in our intellectual property laws. And it isn't just, wow, you know, every time you sing it, you have to send a dime to somebody. It's not that. It follows, this song follows the history of the evolution of those laws. And it is thus fascinating, because whose life has not at one point or other not been touched by the song Happy Birthday?
Well, we're talking right now with Brooke Gladstone. She's co-host and managing editor of NPR's On the Media. And you'll be able to hear On the Media on Fridays at 6 o'clock right after Central Time starting today. And we're welcoming your calls now. How important is it to keep an eye on the media? Do you consider yourself a wise consumer of the media and how it shapes our culture and the lives that we lead? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with NPR's Brooke Gladstone about the unique challenges facing the media today and her show On the Media, and how the media culture has changed along with the show.
And we'd like to hear what you think, too. Does journalism today stand up to enough scrutiny? Does journalism have an obligation to hold lawmakers accountable? When you're looking at all of that media ore, how do you find the nuggets in there? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can drop us an email, talk@WPR.org. You can also leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Brooke, I want to look at one of the shows that On the Media did, one of the questions it took up that I imagine took a lot of courage. On the Media turned the spotlight on the NPR mothership in a way when it explored whether NPR has a liberal bias. Now, on that show, Ira Glass was on board. You had a political scientist. There was a volunteer listener who was a conservative.
We had a few conservatives.
You sat down to really consider that question. Mm-hmm. And first off, I wonder, what was going through your minds when you decided whether or not to tackle that question? I imagine it took courage.
Well, you know, only because many years ago when I was a trade reporter covering media, believe it or not, I did do it before this job, somebody said, why don't you talk about how NPR is drifting to the right? This was back in, like, the early 1980s. And, you know, I think the Progressive magazine asked me to do it. And I couldn't do it because these measurements are so subjective. So my fear wasn't that, you know, there was going to get any blowback from NPR or from the listeners or even from the right because, I mean, let's face it, we're certainly used to that. But it was more just how can we grapple with this when we don't have clear definitions. And so we spent a lot of time talking to the Project for Excellence in Journalism and Pew to try and find out how they define it. And then we took a bunch of conflicting studies and tried to see if we could make some sense out of them. And then we tried to just drop NPR in a continuum, you know, with the New York Times and the Washington Post and Fox News and the Wall Street Journal and CNN, and to see how we, to name a few, and just to see where public radio fit in that continuum. Another thing is that public radio is different from NPR. NPR is a series of programs and a network and a membership organization. It's a lot of things, but it is not the entire voice of public radio. There are lots of other voices on public radio that do not fall under the aegis of national public radio, and that's a complexity that most listeners don't take on. So we knew that these were going to be very muddy waters, but we also felt that to ignore what was such a talking point, both in Congress and on cable and in papers. Just this, you know, is it, isn't it, should, you know, just ducking it, just sticking your head in the sand isn't going to make it go away. And that was a point that Ira Glass was making. You know, he felt NPR was not addressing this. And we thought, okay, we'll try. And it took us three programs to come to a kind of fuzzy conclusion that all listeners can draw their own conclusions from. But as human beings, that's what we do anyway.
What kind of response did you get from that?
Shockingly positive. I think it's because we really tried to be honest with ourselves, and we didn't try to stack the deck. Some did not agree with our conclusions. Some weren't happy with some of the studies that we used. Some felt that, you know, we probably shouldn't have engaged with the issue at all because that was giving lots of ammunition to the right. But the fact is that not the right, nor the left, nor the center got incredibly exercised by what we did, and most people appreciated the sincerity of the effort. And we came up with some really interesting information, and we tried to draw some conclusions, but in the end, it's up to every listener to do that, as it always is.
I'm going to go to the phones now. We've got Joe on the line from Prairie du Chien. Hi, Joe.
Hello. I think one of the problems we have is that the public is bypassing the content that is being presented by the reporter and going directly to their perception of the validity of the data that is being used.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the internet is part of, you know, it, I say problem, but it may be, an opening to a wider approach to how data is used to report the content, as it were.
What sort of data do you mean, Joe? Can you give me an example?
Well, just do we use the government's figures for unemployment, or do we use ADP's?
Uh-huh.
These sort of things. Do you trust the source, I guess, is the biggest thing.
Right, yeah. Trust is such a fundamental.
Okay, thanks, Joe. Let's see what Brooke has to say.
Well, I was just going to tell Joe that trust is the fundamental problem. There's this famous Moynihan quote, which everybody quotes now, ironically, in the current media era. He was a distinguished senator from New York some years ago, and he once said, everyone is entitled to their own opinions, but not to their own facts. And of course, now the argument is that everybody has their own facts, and they're often inconsistent. And in fact, fact is not the word that should be applied to them, but essentially assertions or beliefs that are masquerading as facts. And it is certainly true that you can, I wrote this book a couple of years ago. It was a kind of comic book manifesto history of the media. And in it, I talk about one of the examples I give of this sort of fact-mongering was Lou Dobbs suggesting that Mexican immigrants had led to an increase in leprosy, which, A, was not true, and B, there was no increase in leprosy. Well, there was a brief blip at one point, back 20 years ago when there were a lot of immigrants from Southeast Asia. But, a teeny little blip that immediately went away and had nothing to do with an immigration policy. But he just said, we don't make up our own facts. And the fact is he had. He had willfully misunderstood facts that had come out, changed years, transposed things. I think he may not have made the mistakes consciously, but he believed his mistakes because they fit his thesis. And that's what we do all the time. And trust is the hardest thing to maintain. And in the biggest change between now and 20 years ago is disclosure, I think, builds trust much more than pretending to be completely non-judgmental about the material you're talking about. As a reporter, you become expert in certain things, and you do develop perspectives, and that perspective is something that one can uniquely present.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Joe. And I want to take a look ahead at this week's episode of On the Media.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand you have Craig Silverman of the Regret the Error blog
yes.
on. You also have Cindy Lauper on.
Yes.
And I'm curious about that. How did Cindy Lauper wind up on the Media?
Okay. Well, that's an interesting story. I was doing a series of discussions in the green space. And we define media very broadly. We have a bunch of stories that we call enabling conditions, things that enable you to do journalism. And so we care about First Amendment issues, and we care about freedom of expression, and we care about too much secrecy, not enough disclosure, freedom of expression and freedom of information. We also care about culture, the collision of culture and news, and also how various cultural products get filtered through the era or the technology that they're in. And here's how we get to Cyndi Lauper, who basically I just wanted to talk to right before her show came out. But she talked a lot about being a woman in the business back in the 80s and, you know, how to present one's self completely and not in the box that the other people in the business wanted to put you in. I mean, she was and continues to be an incredibly iconoclastic character. She is an original, and she was being told to dress this way and that, and you know, she responded by, you know, dyeing her hair orange or green and speaking frankly about sexuality and all of these things. But she was rough and raw around the edges. I mean, Madonna did it as a kind of commercial principle, and Cyndi did it as a kind of, I don't want to say anything rude on Wisconsin Public Radio, but as a response to the pressures of the male-dominated music business at the time. And that's part of media.
She's definitely one of a kind. And we actually, as a teaser for your show, we've got a little clip from it. Let's listen.
Okay.
I was signed by this German company. They said to me, we're going to make you into the next Streisand. And I looked at him. I said, what do you want to do that for? I said, what kind of lobotomy do I need? I said, listen, why don't you find somebody else and do that? And I think everybody at the table choked because he happened to be the president. But you know what? If you can't be honest, why do you want to live a life where, and why would you suffer so long to finally get to a place where you couldn't tell the truth and be yourself in the arts and in music?
Clip there from Brooke Gladstone's interview with Cyndi Lauper.
That says it all.
It really does. And we'll hear the whole thing coming up after 6 o'clock. And in our last minute or so, Brooke, I want to ask you, you've got a pretty full life, it sounds like. I heard that your band played at the NPR holiday party recently. True or false?
Well, that was last year.
Last year.
This year, I got to play Marley in the WNYC WQXR radio play of A Christmas Carol. So I gave up my... I decided I didn't have enough time to do that, the show and the band this year. But I'll be back next year.
But you're in a band.
I was a theater major.
You're in a band, huh?
It's the WNYC Radio Flyers Band.
I see. Well, I'm looking forward to having you on the WPR lineup on Friday nights, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us today.
And I want to thank you so much for putting us there.
We're talking to Brooke Gladstone, co-host and managing editor of NPR's On the Media.
Coming up next, a call to make presidential press conferences more relevant. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time. It continues after the news, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.